This is the New Hampshire Now program on KXL. I am Chris Ryan, so please you could join us. This hour of the program is presented by Riverbend Community Mental Health and Choices NH Addiction Recovery Services. May is Mental Health Awareness Month. Tell your story to help drive away the stigma surrounding mental health. For more information, go to riverbendcmhc.org. Riverbend wants you to know that treatment works. New Hampshire primary interviews on the program presented by Rath, Young, and Pignatelli, a national impact that's uniquely New Hampshire. For information, check out rathlaw.com. And interviews on the campaign trail presented by New Futures. Advocate is a verb. For information, check out new-futures.org.
You're listening to New Hampshire Now, presented by the New Hampshire College and University Council, and also by New Futures.
Welcome to Pints of Politics here at the Barley House on 109, 1450, and nhtalkradio.com. I am Chris Ryan, Pints of Politics, presented by New England College. And today on the show, we're very excited to have the governor of Washington, Jay Inslee, join us here on the program. Joined, as always, by Dean Spotis and Wayne Lesperance here. And Governor Inslee, an individual who has focused his campaign almost entirely on the issue of climate change, has rolled out proposals, has discussed this in great detail. So today I think we get into that a little bit, but I want to know a little bit more about Jay Inslee and what he wants to do in regards to being President of the United States, Dean.
Yeah, you know, single-issue candidates traditionally have not done particularly well. The key for him, I think, is going to be to relate climate change, and I have seen him do this already, to a host of other economic and social issues, and that allows him to talk more broadly about policy, because just simply being a single-issue candidate historically has not been a winning strategy. The other thing is, you know, for many years, being a governor was the way to go if you wanted to run for president. You got Carter, Reagan, Clinton, George W. Now he's this group of kind of governors, you know, Hickenlooper's in that mix. Steve Bullock just got in from Montana. They're not all that visible at the moment. So the question's going to be, how are they going to break through? He's trying to do it with climate change. We'll see if that works.
And Wayne and I talked about this in the program on Friday. I think that a single issue candidate, if they make the issue significant enough, can have success. We've seen candidates run based upon, you know, a war that's taking place or a war that needs to be won and to have some sort of success. And Jay Inslee, in my view, is trying to make climate change that type of an issue where this is something that needs to take place within the next administration or doom is going to face our nation, Wayne.
Yeah, and so where we disagreed, and it was an epic disagreement, everybody should tune into that hour, was on whether or not people perceive climate change in the way they perceived existential threats like the Cold War or the War on Terror or something along those lines. So it'd be an interesting thing to ask him about. I think Dean's right, single-issue candidates don't tend to go very far. But maybe folks run for many reasons, and maybe the idea here is to make sure that climate change is a high-profile issue. He has made news this week, Chris, and it's worth noting that whether it's the Cascade Care, the public option health care bill that he signed into law, and he's also made news in talking about job creation, the amount of money he believes needs to be spent. But again, he ties that back to climate change, saying the new jobs that are being created will be connected to climate change-oriented jobs. So lots to talk about. We'll see if we can get him off climate change for a while. I'm not optimistic.
We'll see. Yeah, that's one of the things that a good candidate does, is they bring it back to the topic that they want to discuss. And, you know, for Inslee, I see, you know, a candidate like him, and there's 23 candidates in this race. You need to find a kind of a shoehorn, so to speak, to get yourself into the conversation. And so far, we have not really seen this bring Jay Inslee into the conversation. Perhaps he's hoping the debates are going to be that. But, you know, I think that is kind of his focus, is to create a niche for himself so then he can tell a story. But he needs to obviously tell a story.
It's going
to
be a challenge, though. You know, if you listen to the activists in the base of the Democratic Party, particularly progressives, not the best year to be a white male governor from one of the states. These things have a little bit of a different feel now, obviously. Whereas, as I said, 10, 15 years ago, the key was being a white male governor from one of the states. And so it's a change environment. You know, climate change is, if you look at kind of the most important issue polling, is usually around fourth or fifth in the general electorate. It's certainly higher for Democratic voters. But again, I think I like Wayne's point about the existential threat aspect. But he'll need to figure out how to kind of relate it to a broader suite of issues.
That is Dean Spotis along with Wayne Lesperance. I am Chris Ryan. This is Pints of Politics, the Barley House, at 109, 1450 and nhtalkradio.com. Pints of Politics presented by New England College. When we return, we'll be joined by the governor of Washington, Jay Inslee.
You're listening to New Hampshire Now, presented by the New Hampshire College and University Council, and also by New Futures.
This is the New Hampshire Now program on KXL. I am Chris Ryan, so please you could join us. This hour of the program is presented by Riverbend Community Mental Health and Choices NH Addiction Recovery Services. May is Mental Health Awareness Month. Tell your story to help drive away the stigma surrounding mental health. For more information, go to riverbendcmhc.org. Riverbend wants you to know that treatment works. New Hampshire primary interviews on the program presented by Rath Young and Pignatelli, a national impact that's uniquely New Hampshire. For more information, check out rathlaw.com. And interviews on the campaign trail presented by New Futures. Advocate is a verb. For information, check out new-futures.org.
You're listening to New Hampshire Now, presented by the New Hampshire College and University Council, and also by New Futures.
This is Pints of Politics here at the Barley House on 1039, 1450, and nhtalkradio.com. I am Chris Ryan. Appreciate you joining us for the program, Pints of Politics, presented by New England College. We're honored to be joined on this edition of Pints of Politics, our Road to the White House series, by the Governor of Washington, Jay Inslee, former member of Congress, and he joins us here to discuss his bid for President of the United States. Governor Inslee, how are you?
I'm great. What a beautiful day to be campaigning for president in New Hampshire. What a day.
Indeed it is, and appreciate you joining us for the show. So let's start off with just an upshot of your reason and rationale for running for president. There are a lot of presidential candidates, 23 individuals running for president. What, in your view, uniquely qualifies you to hold the highest office in the nation?
Well, one, I recognize the genius of this show, that you involve ale and good political
and
talks.
And that is basically the only rationale that is needed.
Hopefully that's rational enough, but I'll list another one. I am the candidate that's seen something very clearly and very vocally and very passionately, and that is that we have to make defeating climate crisis the number one job of the United States. And the reason is, if it's not job one, it won't get done. We know that we have an urgent challenge, and we know that this is our last chance, literally our last chance to get on top of this, or we will be toast. And we also know, or I know, that this is one of the greatest economic job-creating engine possibilities ever. So I'm the candidate with a plan that will put 8 million people to work across the United States and seize both this economic initiative and the ability to defeat climate crisis. Now, this is not the only reason that I hope people consider my candidacy. I'm also a supremely successful executive that has brought the highest minimum wage, the best family and medical leave, the first net neutrality bill, the best gender pay bill. I'm going to pardon thousands of people who got caught in the drug law. I've got great teacher pay increases. I've passed the first public option in United States history and the first long-term care plan. So I have a portfolio of success that ought to give us confidence that we can achieve not only the number one priority, which is building a clean energy economy, but doing all of the other things that we need to do that scares the dickens out of the Republicans and puts a spring in the step of everyone who wants a family wage job.
You've pushed forth a plan that has a price tag of $9 trillion over a 10-year period. There's been the Green New Deal, which has been pushed forth as well in Congress. What are the differences between your plan and the Green New Deal, and how do you plan to bring Republicans along, particularly with the jobs incentives?
Well, my ideas are very complementary with the Green New Deal, and I'm glad that those advocates have raised the bar. I've got people thinking about climate change, for goodness sakes. They've also helped by bringing communities of color and those interested in good labor jobs into the discussion. So I've really welcomed it. I think it's been really, really helpful. My plan basically puts meat on the bone. The way I liken it is that, you know, Kennedy said we're going to the moon in 10 years, but we needed to design the Saturn V missile. And my plan designs that missile to get those 8 million jobs. And I just was reading the description. I'm sure you can go on my site and you will see the critiques that have been offered. It's been called everything from a master's thesis for clean energy to a working plan for the next president rather than a campaign slicker or a campaign sticker. So this is not a campaign rhetorical device. This is an actual design of a clean energy economy. It's built on my success in Washington, and that's the other thing I think I offer, which is not rhetorical interest, but actual achievement. I've run a railroad that has created the best economy in the United States, the fastest wage growth, the fastest job growth, and it's been named the U.S. News and World Report best place to live. So I've got a record of success of bringing it home.
Dean?
So, Governor, let's stay on climate change for a little bit longer. And certainly among progressives in the Democratic Party, they've been captivated by the idea of a Green New Deal. You're now talking about maybe doing something that is complementary with that, putting a little bit of meat on the bones of their ideas, so to speak. On the other hand, you look at the U.S. Senate, Mitch McConnell has largely ridiculed the idea. There's a good possibility that even if we have a Democratic president after 2020, Republicans, they may still control the Senate. But if they don't control the Senate, we still may not be at that 60-vote threshold to cut off debate and move to votes. So I guess my question to you is—
And Senate Democrats voted present on that legislation. Senate Democrats voted present on that legislation as well.
And so combine that with— in a general election, obviously it's going to be very popular in a Democratic primary, but in a general election, you look at polling on most important issue, climate change, environment is usually around fifth or sixth. So what is the pitch, not to progressives in the primary, but to somebody like a Mitch McConnell or to somebody else who says, yeah, I can kind of tell it's a problem, but there are a lot of more pressing issues to deal with. How do you win them over?
Well, a variety of ways. First, you have a president who understands a passionate vision statement for the American economy to grow 8 million jobs. And don't tell me presidents don't make a difference. I'm looking over in the wall right here. We got Teddy Roosevelt, what he did for the American dynamic to really say we had to move the country. Now, if we have a president who creates an ignition spark the way John F. Kennedy did, we know what we can do. That's number one. Number two, look, Mitch McConnell has weaponized a way to prevent any progress in the United States, and that's called the filibuster.
Right.
And that's why I was the first candidate to say this very, very vocally. We have to get rid of the filibuster. We can no longer allow Mitch McConnell to stop not just progress on climate change, but progress on health care or anything else. And we Democrats need to stand up and say we stand for democracy. That means the majority votes so that this nation can make progress. Now, how we convince people for two things. One, we believe we need a reality-based president, and not the one who says wind turbines cause cancer. We Democrats know they cause jobs. That's number one. Number two, we now know that we can go around the country showing the incredible job creation that's going on from UAW members making electric cars in Michigan to machinists making wind turbines in Iowa, to folks working Teamsters and sheet metal workers making biofuel plants in Washington. We now can demonstrate that this is the best driver of clean energy of jobs in the nation. Look, clean energy jobs today are growing twice as fast as the rest of the economy. And at some point, reality counts. And those who won't get on the bus, they just need to be removed from public office, and we should free them to private life where they can't do any damage, and that's what we intend to do.
But interesting to me, the operational aspect of this is, if you were elected president, doing away with the 60-vote cloture vote, the filibuster, essentially, to move it forward. You'd support that.
Well, not support it. I'm the first candidate in the race who was willing to stand up to the old senatorial old boys club and girls club that sort of said we had senatorial royalty. We can't stand senatorial baronial privilege anymore. This nation needs to move. It needs to develop a clean energy economy. And the way to do that is elect a president who will lead on getting rid of the filibuster, which you can do with a majority of the votes. So I'm dedicated to that proposition. But first, we need a spark of creativity and confidence. This is a can-do nation. I have proposed a big, bold, and ambitious plan. But this is a big, bold, and ambitious nation, and I'm ready to light that fire.
I think the way you introduced yourself today, talking about cascade care, the public option, talking about job creation and all of those things, helps to define you as not a single-issue candidate. But
right.
if we do a Google search on your name, the overwhelming amount of results initially are going to focus on what you've had to say about climate change. The American people have shown that they can rally around single issues when we've seen existential threats in the past, whether it was the Cold War, the War on Terror, or going back even further, World War II. The American people can be mobilized to do things that are big things, as you would say. So I'm not sure that they're there yet. Make the case. It's not just about convincing members of Congress, but how do you get the American people to recognize climate change the way you do as an existential threat that really requires an all-in approach?
Well, number one, we should not allow ourselves to be the prisoners of history. You know, the only way things change is things change. Yeah, we have done things one way 200 years, and all of a sudden we reach a tipping point where the public is ready to move forward. I believe we are at that tipping point. And the reason is that people used to look at this as a chart on a graph. I co-authored a book on how to build a clean energy economy 12 years ago. And at that time, climate change was a line on a graph of parts per million. Now it's seen a town of 25,000, Paradise, California, burned down where I went and visited. It looked like a post-apocalypse movie. It's getting to know a woman named Regina Haddock I met 2 days ago in Davenport, Iowa. She had a nonprofit to help single women get back on their feet. It's now been totally destroyed. Her dreams are certainly on hold at the best. And when she was crying about this, I saw a person who represented what we want to protect against. And so now that people are seeing this in the real world and seeing that their kids are getting jobs in the clean energy economy and going to the places where those jobs are, we can have confidence in how we can build this. And I've been many an argument with the pessimists. And that's the other thing. The central debate here is between the can-do people and the can't-do people. I believe we can build clean energy jobs. We know we're doing that. The fastest growing job in America is solar installer. The number three or four is carpenter, laborer, IBW member who does retrofits on houses and buildings, real construction people. But you got a guy in the White House who's a pessimist who doesn't think we can do that. He wants to hide behind walls. And that's the other thing that I offer people is a willing to stand up to Donald Trump. I was the first guy to stand up against the Muslim ban. I was the first governor who says Syrian refugees are welcome in my state, and we need a stand-up guy to beat him.
Why, in your view, though, are the American people slow to recognize this as an existential threat? As an example, when we saw what ISIS was doing to individuals, including journalists and James Foley coming from New Hampshire, his family living on the seacoast, there was a feeling of America needs to act. America needs to move forward and do something about ISIS. And we see this imagery. Is it because that the answer is not cut and dry, where ISIS is there, we go and we attack them, and that is what we do, and whatever money we spend in order to achieve the results that we desire? Why, in your view, is climate change different in the view of so many people, where even in the Democratic Party, if you went through the list of what individuals care about the most, it's not necessarily in the top three?
Several reasons. Number one, we should blame evolution, because evolution has taught us to focus on the lion chasing us rather than, you know, potential food shortages 3 months later. I mean, it's just the nature of we're humans, right? Mm-hmm. This is a human response. And this is a very relatively slow-moving emergency. When your house catches fire, it takes 10 minutes to understand the problem. Mm-hmm. This one takes place over decades and centuries. But the second reason that is inexcusable is because we have a president and largely a party that is now a complete captive of him and afraid to stand up against him, who denies the pure science. Look, when you have the president of the United States telling millions of America that this is a Chinese hoax, because he wants to give the entire government of the United States to his lobbyist pals for the coal and oil industry. Look, he's put coal and oil industry lobbyists in charge of our health and our public spaces. Mm-hmm. And that is an outrage. The other day, one of his secretaries, who's an oil and gas lobbyist, a congressman asked him in a hearing, are you concerned that we're now at 415 parts per million? This is the highest in, 800,000 years. We've never experienced this during humanity, probably, or close to that. And he said, I don't lose any sleep over that. Well, we lose a lot of sleep over allowing Donald Trump 4 more years to allow us to go over the cliff of climate crisis. And I'm dedicated to make sure that doesn't happen. And I have a message of economic growth that I believe can defeat him, like I did when we defeated him when we elected 7 new Democratic governors. And 5 in the Midwest, because I understand an economic message that can defeat Republicans. I was in Raymond this morning. We just had a really great town hall meeting in Raymond, and it just reminded me of Selah, Washington. I was in a 63% Republican agricultural district when I beat my first Republican, and I've beat half dozen or a dozen since. I know how to win these things, and I look forward to it.
So before we hit the break here, and we'll get into more policy questions in the second half of our conversation with you, do some process. And in your mind, what needs to happen in order for you to reach that moment where you do catch fire within this particular race? And do you see yourself meeting the thresholds to be on the debate stage?
Well, I am just exactly where I have been almost in every race, every time I've beat a Republican, and that is as an underdog. So I'm comfortable being in this position. I've started 20 or 16 points behind almost every race I've been in. So I'm a lesser-known candidate, and I am in a position that another guy was in from a small state governor named Jimmy Carter and another guy named Billy Clinton. And they started where I'm starting. Mm-hmm. And it's not so much catching fire. It is a more of a slow climb than necessarily an enormous rocket launch here. But I think what we're finding is that certainly in the Democratic Party, the polling shows clearly that Democrats agree with me. They now put defeating climate change as the number one priority, either tied or ahead of health care. And this is a rapidly changing dynamic. I think I've captured where the soul of the Democratic Party is right now. And I have married this with something that is unique amongst the candidates. Look, we got a lot of talent in the field. I've identified at least 18 potential vice presidents in the field. So there's a lot of talent.
Who have you eliminated?
That's a secret.
Just
list.
Kidding.
But I'm unique in that I've actually got things done. Look, talking about things is great. There's been some wonderful ideas proposed by some of these candidates. But there's really only one candidate that's got a 100% clean energy bill, one candidate that's passed the best family leave, one candidate that has the most robust plan for low-income families to put their kids through college. So that's the record of success I bring to this. That should give us confidence.
Have you met the thresholds to reach the debate stage at this point?
It depends what the rules end up being, but we're at the polling number, and we're about 4,000 away from the 65,000. So anybody out there wants to be the last person to make a $1 contribution at jamesley.com, I can't legally buy you lunch, but I can write you an accommodation letter for the Nobel Peace Prize. So you can go to jansley.com and get in that competition.
Go ahead, Dean.
Governor, let's talk a little bit of foreign policy. President Trump has had a couple summits with President Kim of North Korea, but it seems like they're slowly but surely continuing to move along with their nuclear program, additional missile launches in recent days. He pulled out of the deal with Iran, and now there's a lot of confusion about what our stance towards that country should be. So my question to you is, how much of a priority should actual denuclearization of these countries be, or would you focus more on containing what they already have, or is it just an overblown threat overall? And if not, how would you deal with it?
Well, I don't think any nuclear weapon is an overblown threat in the sense of the energy and danger that it poses. I think that's particularly true with unstable regimes and unstable people. So I don't want to minimize the nature of that threat. But I do believe that this president has made about every mistake he could in trying to deal with it. And his first huge mistake is that virtually everything he does is more designed for a photo op than it is real progress. And if you look at what he does, it's always the photo op. It's always the press release. It's always the tweet of the day. It's not a concerted, strategic, thoughtful idea with an end game in mind. And I'm not just saying that. Republican senators are now recognizing that. Number two, he has weakened our ability to constrain Korea or China, because if you're going to fight a battle, it sure is great to have allies. Mm. You know, we did better in World War II with allies than without them.
Right.
And this president has alienated every potential ally. He's stuck his finger in their eye just for sort of showmanship purposes to show what a big man he is. And so he's weakened our ability to be successful in this regard. Look, yes, we do need to put pressure on China. Their intellectual property system has been injurious to us, and I've been active in that. But just lashing out that is now costing us billions of dollars throughout and costing jobs, including in my state, by the thousands, without any end game in mind, with no allies to help you, and with no consistent strategy, that's typical Trump, and it's not good for America.
But how hard would you push at its core to remove the nuclear technology from North Korea and Iran?
Well, just the right amount at the right time, based on strategic thought and the advice of the Pentagon and our intelligence agencies, rather than rash emotional outbursts that we're getting. And if you talk to the intelligence agencies, as I've had, they will tell you that this is a president who does not listen to them at all, doesn't even read their briefings. Look, they've been trying to tell him for 2 years now that the climate crisis is a national security threat because it causes mass migration. We're seeing that in our southern border right now. It destabilized the Horn of Africa. It caused political instability. It led to violence. We have military people deployed in combat today in part because of the climate crisis, in a sense. He has totally ignored this because it doesn't fit in his version of trying to keep his base happy. We need someone who's caring about America's security rather than his base.
That is Jay Inslee. He is the governor of Washington joining us here for Pints of Politics at the Barley House Democratic presidential candidate. We're going to take a quick break and come back after this. This is Pints of Politics presented by New England College.
You're listening to New Hampshire Now, presented by the New Hampshire College and University Council and also by New Futures.
This is the New Hampshire Now program on KXL. I am Chris Ryan, so please you could join us. This hour of the program is presented by Riverbend Community Mental Health and Choices NH Addiction Recovery Services. May is Mental Health Awareness Month. Tell your story to help drive away the stigma surrounding mental health. For more information, go to riverbendcmhc.org. Riverbend wants you to know that treatment works. New Hampshire primary interviews on the program presented by Rath Young and Pignatelli, a national impact that's uniquely New Hampshire. For more information, check out rathlaw.com. And interviews on the campaign trail presented by New Futures. Advocate is a verb. For information, check out new-futures.org.
You're listening to New Hampshire Now, presented by the New Hampshire College and University Council and also by New Futures.
This is Pints of Politics here at the Barley House. You're on 1039, 1450 and nhtalkradio.com. Pints of Politics presented by New England College. We're joined by the Governor of Washington, Jay Inslee, for Pints of Politics. And here is Wayne Lesprance.
Governor, let's shift gears and talk about veterans. My father is a 100% disabled veteran. I spent a lot of my youth with my father at VA hospitals. I've seen the good. I've also seen the bad. This president, President Trump, made a lot of promises about fixing the VA system and making sure our veterans got the best possible care. I'll leave it to you to comment on how well he's done on that. But more importantly, what's your plan to make sure veterans get the care they were promised?
Well, first off, please thank your father and all vets you know, because we want to thank them for what they've done for the nation. Look, you can't lay all of the problems in the VA system on this particular president. They have been longstanding. This has been a long road to try to improve the system. I don't see any evidence that this president has shown any particular interest or resources or personal commitment to this issue. So I have to believe there are things that could have been better if you'd had better, more aggressive presidential leadership. Our veterans, we have done some very successful things in my state. In my very first executive order I ever issued was to try to reestablish our hiring and our transition services for veterans. And I'm pleased to tell you that we now provide our veterans the single best transition services in the United States. For instance, at JBLM, Joint Base Lewis-McChord, we have our soldiers, before they muster out, they get really prolonged counseling and skills development for months before they muster out, so they go in ready for jobs the day they get out. We also have a program called CAMEL for Commerce, so we help training for soldiers so they can start businesses when they get out. And the Pentagon is sort of modeling their national efforts after what we have done. I'm very proud of that. We've also been very intent on hiring veterans because we know the tremendous talent. So we've really focused on recruiting veterans into our state employment. And if you know any that you don't hire in New Hampshire, send them my way, and we want to get them working.
To the economy now, and there are significant challenges that exist within rural and urban settings across our country. And they have not been dramatically helped by the Trump administration, despite promises to do so. I'm curious as to what type of economic plan you would push forth to both spur rural and urban development, which obviously have differing sets of conditions that you need to tackle, but a lot of the same problems exist, where there was a feeling and philosophy that economic opportunity would come in urban settings. It has not. In rural settings, they've been promised for years that the jobs were going to come back, and then that the new jobs were going to come in. So what do we need to do to first stabilize and then to increase economic opportunity in those two areas?
Well, first, elect a president who raised his three sons in a town of 3,000 amongst the apple orchard and sagebrush of the Yakima Valley in eastern Washington. And I say that, and I'm serious about that, because I just have small towns in my heart. When I was in Raymond today, it looked like where I raised my three mm-hmm. kids for 20 years. And I understand.
And Raymond is a lot of ways the epitome of New Hampshire.
It is.
Small town, Main Street.
Small town and beautiful Main Street. Really nice group of people we met today. But I spent 20 years trying to build the economy of my community. I went to the state legislature focused on economic development. When I started, I focused on the things that are obvious, that are important, which is infrastructure development, mm-hmm. to make sure you have good transportation systems in small communities. First thing I ever did was to improve an overpass to get to my local community so we could increase economic development. But now we know the new interstate is broadband, and that's why I just passed one of the first broadband bills in the country to give smaller and rural communities access to broadband, because we know access to broadband is absolutely pivotal. If you're going to start a small business and want to sell your product around the world, you've got to have access. If you want to be a student at a college, access to broadband. If you want remote medicine and get a neurologist to diagnose your MRI, access to broadband. So we've had a big step in that. But third, and I'm going to come back to this, some of the greatest economic development successes I'm seeing in small communities are in clean energy. So the largest manufacturer of carbon fiber that goes into electric cars is not in Seattle or San Francisco. It's in a small town called Moses Lake in central Washington. The largest manufacturer of biofuels in the West Coast is not in Los Angeles. It's in Grays Harbor, Washington, making biofuels that takes raw product from Iowa and makes it in biofuels. The largest solar plant in my state is not in Tacoma, our second largest or third largest city. It's in a town of 350, Lind, Washington. And the reason this is good for small towns is that frequently our new clean energy systems need sort of a natural resource base. They need land and they need employment. And the fourth thing I'll mention is we need skills. And I've developed an entirely new way to give skills development called Career Connected Washington, which is basically an apprenticeship program. Mm-hmm. Look, I think we've made a mistake for the last several decades telling our kids if you don't get a four-year degree, you're a failure. We need to provide an avenue for success for all of the skilled trades to get people in these apprenticeships. So we've now done it in healthcare. We've actually graduated the first computer coding apprenticeship program mm-hmm. in the state. So there's a four-point plan, and we'll try to make everybody as beautiful as Raymond.
Dean?
Governor, let's talk a little bit more about infrastructure. You know, there have been these periodic attempts as recently as a few weeks ago when President Trump and Democratic leaders said they'd agreed to $2 trillion in infrastructure, and it's kind of faded from view a little bit. And it seems every time they go to Congress with a significant infrastructure proposal, there's just tremendous disagreement over how to fund it. Democrats want a direct federal investment, kind of like President Obama's stimulus package back in 2009. Republicans want private investment, and they just seem to be at loggerheads. How would you envision funding a $1 or $2 trillion, or whatever figure you have in mind, national infrastructure package?
Well, the first thing is we've got to realize we need to get our priorities straight. And this president had a priority to hand out billions of dollars of tax goodies to his best friends and their lobbyists and the gas and oil and coal companies. And that's what he did. He handed out billions of dollars. He made a decision to hand out billions of dollars to his friends rather than to hand out infrastructure assistance to local communities, including small towns and rural communities.
How do you
and
make
that's a decision. So how do you pay for it? Yeah. Well, one of the ways we got to do it is to reel back in the billions of dollars we're given to the oil and gas and coal companies and ill-gotten subsidies that are no longer necessary. These are old, mature technologies. There's no reason for this subsidy. It's just a payoff system for the lobbyists of these industries. Then we need to roll back the Trump tax cuts so we can restore some degree of progressivity in our system and then get to work. Now, I am capable of doing these things, even working with Republicans. I have $70 billion of transportation infrastructure going on in my state when Donald Trump can't build a birdhouse. And that's because I worked with Republicans. I had a Republican Senate, and I got this job done because I was a good listener, and where we had to make compromises, I did it. But I was dedicated to getting a job done, and I intend to do that if I'm given this honor.
Wayne?
Let's switch gears again. Let's go to education. This morning, Vice President Biden talked quite a bit about free community college. Senator Sanders, Senator Warren have talked about free college. I think if you talk to any college professor, there's two of us here, our college administrator, they'll tell you you're hard-pressed to actually come up with a plan for free college that really is affordable because we have to pay bills as well. So how do we make education very accessible, especially to those folks that need it the most, but at the same time, not with an empty promise of free this, free that? That's not usually tenable.
So first thing we do is make sure we have teachers and professors there to teach. And the only way you do that is to pay them an adequate salary. That's why I'm proud, as the son of a biology teacher, that I got an average 12% pay increase for every educator in our public school system this year. So, and I say this seriously because people forget that you have to have the infrastructure for the system, including decently paid teachers. And I believe the most important thing in education is a high-quality teacher and professor. So I put my money where my mouth is. Second, I think we should focus not on sound bites, but on real programs. And what I've done in my state is we have created the richest, most robust system of support for lower income families to make sure they do get free college. So we do have free college in my state already, but not just tuition. Tuition's not enough. If you are, you know, living on $18,000 a year, you can't go to college just because you have free tuition. So what we have done is we have created the richest scholarship program that provides the full meal deal. You get essentially everything it costs to go to college if your family's under $50,000 of income. And so that's the first priority. And then you build from there. The other thing we need to do is making sure the college's buildings work, which means you have capital budgets to have buildings and computer systems to work.
Would you incentivize specific courses of study? So students that want a major they want majors that will lead to clean energy jobs. Shouldn't the government be incentivizing students to follow that path? Is there a way along those lines that would make sense?
Well, we are going to be incentivizing because we're going to be creating millions of those jobs, which are going to inspire students to go into those areas. So in the most important way, yes, which makes sure we create those jobs in the first place.
Briefly, what is your solution in regards to health care? We've heard Medicare for All from a lot of candidates, but it mm-hmm. means different things. How would you utilize the private insurance industry, or would you like a Bernie Sanders plan, which is strictly a Medicare for All solution, which would eliminate private insurance?
Well, just to tell you what we've done so far in Washington, we've successfully insured 800,000 people. We have probably one of, if not the most successful implementations of Obamacare. And I mention this because you need to implement things. You need to run the railroad, and I've had experience doing that. And as I've indicated, we now are the first to have a public option, which will be the first state-sanctioned system that will give a guarantee of access to everybody in our state, in every part of our state, at every income levels of our state, and will drive down the cost, ultimately, for everyone. And so we would build on that. On the federal level, we ought to immediately reduce the age eligibility for Medicare. We ought to have access to everyone who wants Medicare. You might call it Medicare for All who want it. We need to think about automatic enrollment for people when they're born, so they are coming into the Medicare system in day one. Now, the question is, should we criminalize having private insurance? I don't think so. Mm-hmm. So I'm not one of those guys that makes it a felony to have private insurance, because I think a lot of folks do use and enjoy their private insurance plan. But we have to have universal coverage. We have to have a right to health care. It is a moral responsibility, and we're going to get that job done.
In conclusion, you like the premise of this question. The year is 2029. You've served two presidents, two terms as president of the United States. What will you have given the American people? What have you accomplished, and what will you have given them?
Well, that's a long list. I mean, number one, a president that doesn't lie to you every hour, number one. Number two, a president who believes that you need an economy who works for everyone, and you've built a middle-out economy rather than a trickle-down economy. You know, the president thinks he's got a great economy. For some, that's very true. But for half of Americans who have not had a wage increase in 20 years, that is simply not true. That is why in my clean energy plan, I've built in programs that call for greater rights to have unions, better prevailing wages, assistance to people for their heating and cooling costs. I've built in programs where everyone participates in a better economy. clearly, I want to say that we have arrested the climate change crisis, and that we've created 8 million jobs. And I think all of those things are possible with the right leadership. And we need progress on all of the things. And here's how I look at this, frankly. I want to give everybody in America what people in my state have: the first public option, the best protection against paying women less than men, protection of a woman's right of choice, a gender parity act, elimination of the death penalty, adequately paid teachers. All of the things that I've accomplished in Washington State, I think, can be accomplished across the United States. And I have a list of about 10 things that I've done in the last 6 years that are first in the nation. Now they need to be nationwide. And if we can say America got what my state got in the last 6 years, boy, that'd be a big victory party.
Governor Inslee, thanks so much for your time. Thanks for stopping in to have Pints of Politics with us, and look forward to seeing you again soon.
Good luck to your son's baseball career.
All right, appreciate that. That is Jay Inslee, Governor of Washington, joining us for Pints of Politics here at the Barley House, presented by New England College. We'll come back and wrap things up after this.
You're listening to New Hampshire Now, presented by the New Hampshire College and University Council, and also by New Futures.
This is Pints of Politics here at the Barley House, 109, 1450, and nhtalkradio.com. We're just joined by the Governor of Washington, Jay Inslee, Democratic candidate for president, and really enjoyed his appearance on the show, heavy on policy, and a good conversation with the Governor of Washington, Dean.
Yeah, I think it was a good introduction for listeners. You know, he is a sitting governor, so it was really interesting to hear what it is he likes about what he's accomplished in his state and how that would translate to a federal level. I think we gave him a pretty good discussion on climate change and get a better idea of how he would actually make that stick as a policy issue. And so I think it was a very useful discussion. He's clearly thought a lot about how he could.
I'll give you an email.
Okay, sounds good.
I'll edit.
Yeah.
He's, so in three, 2, 1, he's clearly given.
Yeah. I think he's clearly given us a good initial sense of how he would translate what he's accomplished in Washington State to a national level.
Wayne?
I think we covered a lot of issues. I think I was wrong. I thought he would not get far away from climate change, and we spent plenty of time on it. But great answers on healthcare, great answers on jobs and on education. So certainly a thoughtful person with a point of view and lots of experience. Voters have a tremendous amount of choice this cycle.
That's what I was thinking, too, in that in the past, Jay Inslee would be one of the leading candidates for President of the United States on the Democratic side. I don't think there's any question in regards to that. When you consider what he has accomplished in Washington, you know, there's a challenge of being way out on the West Coast and the political universe being, you know, more in Washington and New York and here in New Hampshire, first and foremost, of course. But I feel like in the past that he would be one of the leading candidates here.
Well, for many years, as I said at the beginning of the show, we had the dominance of the white male governors, and he certainly is far away from D.C. geographically, pretty much as you can get, other than Alaska and Hawaii. So he would traditionally present himself as an outsider and show how he's going to take what he's done in Washington State and bring it to the national scene. But it's a different environment now, and I think there are going to be some real challenges for him that wouldn't have been there 10 or 15 years ago.
The Democratic Party has changed, the country has changed, and so what used to work doesn't seem to be working anymore. And you know, that doesn't mean he doesn't have great ideas. The great challenge that Democrats have right now is they have lots of very qualified, very serious people running. It's an embarrassment of riches, but that doesn't help him in this particular race. It's a great place for Democratic voters to be, though.
So if you're him, how do you break through? I mean, is this the traditional type of campaign where he talks about his accomplishments and says, look, I've done all these things. I have actually accomplished everything that you, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and Cory Booker say you want to accomplish. I've already done it, and here's how I've done it. Is that how he breaks through? Does he break through via climate change? If you were advising him about how to utilize, and as we heard, it looks like he will be on the debate stage. He's 4,000 donors away from reaching the debate stage. How do you utilize that moment to make your argument to folks?
His punchback right now on Joe Biden has been Joe Biden is too moderate. He's too mainstream. That he's not pushing hard enough on climate. And I think he can continue to do that. I think his way forward is he has to be the first one to step up and start taking folks on, really going after the individual candidates, make a name for himself. So if he sticks with climate change as his singular issue, I don't think he gets there. He's going to have to surprise folks with the other issues that he's got a strong position on, but he's going to have to get physical in this race.
And he's going to have to push back against this narrative that is clearly out there among progressives that the party has moved past the era of the white male governor as the standard bearer for the party. That's a real challenge. I hear it almost every day from progressive analysts. I'm not sure if he has an answer for that yet. We sort of got him started thinking about it.
Well, Dean Wayne, that was great. Appreciate you joining us for the program.
Sure thing.
Thanks, Chris.
Dean Smildes, Wayne Lesperance here for Pints and Politics, the Barley House, presented by New England College. Thanks to Washington Governor Jay Inslee for joining us here. I am Chris Ryan. Have a great rest of the day, everybody.